part of why and how protest works is that it brings people together in real space, in real time. We put our bodies next to each other. We feel our sense of ourselves as a collectivity, which is a thing that, you know, happens in houses of worship all the time where people get together. There's a power in that, a power especially, not sort of like in spite of this internet age, but especially because so many of us live so much of our lives digitally, that part of the enduring power of protest is that it brings us together to speak as one in a physical space. And we know from history that that matters and that the impact of that plays out over a long time.
That's L.A. Kaufman, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features L.A. Kaufman and Anila Afzali on the enduring power of protest. Are marches and demonstrations just feel-good affairs? You vent some spleen, then you go home satisfied, as if you've done something worthwhile. And then, before you know it, the glow wears off. Or does the power of collective action, solidarity, and mass mobilizations have a deeper effect? The key to resistance is organization leading to sustained efforts. The danger of demonstrations is if they are not connected to movements. The former is episodic, whereas movements are enduring. The historic 1963 March on Washington for Civil Rights and the subsequent anti-Vietnam War demonstrations had a major impact. Those protests attracted hundreds of thousands. Since the Trump inauguration in January 2017, there have been more protests than during any comparable period in U.S. history. Literally millions have turned out. People are getting off of tweets and into the streets in larger and larger numbers. To discuss the enduring power of protest is L.A. Kaufman and Anila Afzali. L.A. Kaufman is a veteran organizer of mass marches and direct action protests. She's the author of How to Read a Protest, The Art of Organizing and Resistance. Anila Afzali is the executive director of the American Muslim Empowerment Network at the Muslim Association of Puget Sound in Washington. She was named the 2018 American Muslim of the Year by the Council on American-Islamic Relations. They spoke at Town Hall in Seattle. First, we hear from L.A. Kaufman.
I've been an organizer of various kinds for a very long time. And in particular, I've been involved in a lot of direct action organizing. That's what my first book was about. But I've also been involved in mass protest organizing. And in particular, I was the mobilizing coordinator for the New York protest in February 15th, 2003, which still stands as, it was part of what is still the largest single day of protest in world history. So many millions of people all around the world mobilized to try to stop George Bush from waging war against Iraq, that it still has not been exceeded. And it also didn't work, right? We did not stop that war from happening. I went on to be the mobilizing coordinator for quite a few other major protests coordinated by United for Peace and Justice, including the march outside the 2004 Republican Convention in New York City, which still stands as one of the very largest protests in U.S. history. We had 800,000 people there, making it one of, you know, maybe the top five or six protests by size for a single event in the U.S. It also didn't work. We didn't stop George Bush from getting reelected after that march. It wasn't the only factor in trying to stop his reelection. But being part of those events, which on the one hand felt so extraordinarily powerful and successful in terms of turnout, and had such questionable impact in terms of policy, haunted me for years and years. I never doubted that we were right to do it. I never doubted that we were right to try to stop the war on Iraq. And I think it's important for people to stand up and say that they don't agree with what's happening, even if they don't think they can change the course of events. I think it's important to do that for your sense of self and integrity. And I think it's important to do it because we don't always know what we accomplish when we do that. We don't know what the long-term effects are going to be. But nonetheless, something about the particular disjuncture between the incredible response that we had in our organizing and the really small impact that we had haunted me for years and has been in the back of my mind, and was in the back of my mind when I attended the Women's March in right after Donald Trump was inaugurated in 2017. When I went there, I wasn't quite sure what to expect. I'd been to so many big protests over the years that a lot of them had kind of come to seem boring to me. You go and you march, you listen to a bunch of speakers at a rally, and then you end up asking yourself, what did we do? What did we accomplish? I haven't always felt that way about smaller protests, which are more targeted often and more focused, part of an ongoing campaign. But these big gatherings where we come together in such huge numbers, what exactly do they do? So I was really struck by the 2017 Women's March, by how different it felt and by how different it seemed from any of these big gatherings I had been to over the decades before. This book, in looking at this march and contrasting it with the 1963 March on Washington, the one where Dr. King gave his famous I Have a Dream speech, I looked closely at those two marches and think about how protest had changed over time in order to try to get a handle on what protest does, on why and how and when it works. This book uses partly as its point of departure the signs that people used at the protests. If you look at these signs here at the 63 March, you'll see how uniform they all look, how they all have the same typeface, they all have a small number of slogans. And it turns out, as I was doing the research for this book, that this is not accidental, that this was a very, very deliberate, conscious choice. This march, most people don't realize, I didn't realize until I started looking closely at the history, was the first mass march in America. We hadn't had a mass march on Washington before. There had been parades and there had been some smaller things. There had been things, of course, like the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade, and there had been these kind of pageants and processions that happened that were done by groups from suffragettes to the Ku Klux Klan in Washington. But this, the mass mobilization, was brand new. People were very nervous about the idea of bringing a 250,000 people together in one place in Washington, D.C. And people were particularly nervous about bringing 250,000 mostly black people together in Washington, D.C. And there was a lot of racist panic about how there was sure to be rioting, there was sure to be disorder, there were going to be all of these problems. So the organizers, including A. Philip Randolph and the great organizer Bayard Rustin, if anything, they erred on the side of too much control in order to be sure that they had a peaceful, orderly gathering that would reflect well on the civil rights movement of the time. One of the choices, the organizing choices that they made, was this choice, which seems really bizarre in retrospect, to control all the signs. If you've mobilized a crowd of a 250,000 or more, trust me, it's really hard to get them to all do the same thing. So the idea that they could pull this off sort of flabbergasted me, and I got a good sense from looking in the archives of how they did it. I mean, they had this incredible force of volunteer marshals to keep the peace, and they would just go up to people and surround them and take their signs away if somebody brought their own handmade sign. Now, part of what had stood out to me at the Women's March in 2017 was that it had the very highest percentage of handmade signs I thought I had ever seen at a protest. And when you go and you look at the data about office supply sales in the run-up to the march, it's confirmed. People couldn't find any more foam core and magic markers. I mean, they were selling out all over the country. There was a way in which that drive for people to create their own signs and express their own view of why they were there as opposed to carrying a sign that was written by somebody else, sort of paralleled a lot of other things about that mobilization that made it distinctive. That this was, in so many ways, the way these 2017 women's marches came together was so different from anything we've ever seen in the past, in how they started on the internet and were a kind of just viral groundswell. There were certainly established organizations that stepped up to help and to help make them happen and to handle a lot of the kind of boring nuts and bolts stuff that people don't realize goes into making a big protest like this, anything from, you know, porta potties to, you know, working with the mass transit to make sure that you can get everybody there. There were people who were experienced organizers who stepped up, but so much of it was new. So much of it was this kind of viral creation by women who were alarmed, disgusted, horrified by Donald Trump's ascendancy to the presidency. I never say his election because I do not think he was legitimately elected. And there was a way in which this groundswell that wasn't controlled by any organization had a feeling on that day. There was a feeling in D.C. In theory, they had a march route, but in practice, we just flowed through the streets like water. There were so many people, and we so overwhelmed any kind of volunteer infrastructure that we just took over the streets in this way that felt more like an uprising than it did like one of these staged, carefully ordered marches. It was an utterly peaceful uprising and quite an extraordinary coming together. The joy that we took in just seeing each other's signs was so powerful. But what was really remarkable, though, was this was only one of some 650 marches that took place around the country. To give you a sense of perspective, before those women's marches, I can't come up with many examples where there was ever a case where there were more than 200 coordinated protests on one day. Having protests coordinated around the country is a common thing. But before the women's marches, it had been kind of this clunk of major cities, about the same cities that when there were civil rights coordinated protests in the 60s still had them again in the 80s and then the 90s and then up until the recent day. And this was like just an explosion that happened everywhere, from the bottom up, led by women, done kind of improvisationally, all over the country, in every single congressional district. Now, from the vantage point of 2 years later, I think you see exactly those same qualities, for example, in the incredible get-out-the-vote mobilization that we saw for the midterms. All over the country, decentralized, women-led, improvisational, bottom-up, mobilizing the kind of work that multiplies your effect. You have one vote, but if you get out the vote, you multiply the impact that you have. And it happened all over the country. And a lot of it wasn't driven by the Democratic Party. It was driven either by advocacy groups or by the thousands of local resistance groups that people formed after these marches. People formed at least 6,000 local resistance groups. It's contracted somewhat in the last 2 years, but it's only contracted to about 5,000. And that, just to give you, you know, a numerical comparison, the Tea Party at its height had 800 to 1,000 groups. We talk so much about how powerful and influential the Tea Party was, and we right out of the gate had at least six times their numbers in terms of local groups and organizing nodes. When I look at those protests, at those women's marches, I see them, but are they going to pass any legislation? There's this way in which we impose on protests this litmus test of whether or not they lead to short-term legislative change. And that's how we assess whether they had an impact or not. But that's not how change happens. If you're going to get to the point where you're creating legislative change, there's going to have been many, many other ingredients and many, many other factors along the way, some of which is protest and a lot of which is not. A lot of which is work that is less glamorous, like all the get out the vote work that people have been doing, where they were going around, you know, making phone calls, sending texts, knocking on doors. It's not glamorous. You're not with a ton of other people when you're doing it, but it's crucial. And you need something that gives you that sense of being part of something larger than yourself to keep doing it. And that's one of the things that protests do. There's many, many different kinds of protests, and how there's a tendency to kind of collapse and conflate them all when people talk about protest. It was just a few days after the women's marches that we had the Muslim ban protests in airports all around the country, which was another example of a real grassroots groundswell of another kind. You know, it was a crisis emergency response. It was not, contrary to some people's myths about it, it was not like a fully spontaneous event. There were longstanding immigrant rights organizers, Murad Awada from the New York Immigration Coalition, who knew that this ban was coming, had planned for some kind of response, had a text network in place, had, you know, other forms of outreach in place, so they were ready, boom, when the moment, the crisis moment hit, to put out a call. But anybody who's been an organizer knows, like, sometimes you put out a call to action and you get three people. Even though it's a pressing, urgent issue, people are tired or there's something sometimes ineffable about these moments. So this was a moment of powerful groundswell, of a real grassroots uprising. It was on a different scale from the women's marches. I mean, it did touch every single international airport in the U.S. and a bunch of other airports as well. There were cities that didn't have, you know, had airports where there would be no international flights arriving, but people still wanted to make a stand, so they showed up and held a protest at those airports as well. In the matter of, it seemed like minutes, these unfolded over the course of a day. There's something in this, although the numbers here, I think the numbers at JFK probably never got above 5,000. There's something in that willingness to rise up that is so precious and that is so needed. I'm going to take a minute now to read you a couple of passages from the book. So the first is about the power of protest. Part of the power of the women's marches was that they never even pretended to be about applying direct pressure on the new president. They were sending a different kind of signal. The trajectory of movements is long and slow and complex. Protests do sometimes force direct concessions. Smaller, sustained, targeted ones do so more effectively than mass mobilizations. But that's far from the only way they can be effective. Organizing isn't a science, it's an art. When the odds are against you, protests can shift the term of public debate or expand the sense of what's politically possible. They can motivate people on the sidelines to step up and take action. They can put an issue on the agenda or increase the urgency with which it is addressed. They introduce friction where injustice depends on the illusion of harmony. The work that protests do often can't be seen in the moment. Their effects tend to be subtle, dispersed, and catalytic. There are occasions, of course, when you're destined to lose whatever it is you're fighting for, and a protest is just a cry of frustration. But other times, the arc of history does bend towards justice, and there are magical moments when, often quite suddenly, you win. Protesting is always an act of faith, a gamble that action might spark more action, that inspiration will travel in unpredictable ways, that taking a bold public stand will set new forces in motion, that justice will prevail. Perhaps the biggest challenge that movements face is sustaining the hope that's required for people to keep taking action over time. So sometimes the most consequential way a mass protest can work is by changing the protesters themselves, giving them the taste of collective power they need to stay in the fight. The day of the women's march in D.C., there was a moment at the end of the day when the huge crowds, there weren't that many marshals relative to the number of crowds, so people were just kind of flowing around. And people were all around the White House. And I was with two very long-term direct action organizer friends of mine. I had this vision that if we had the capacity to pull together a couple of tactical teams, we could have just gotten all the women to stay. To just stay outside the White House on Donald Trump's first night there. just, I don't know, make some noise, hang out. Wasn't imagining a blockade. It was more like just a presence. I looked back in the historical record, and there was one time in 1970 when that happened. I write about it in the book, when anti-war activists after the Kent State shootings converged in Washington, D.C., and Nixon freaked out so much that he surrounded the White House with a ring of 60 buses to keep them away. And so I write, nothing at all like that happened on the day that Trump took office. Neither a raucous occupation like the one of 1970 or some imagined woman-led alternative. Instead, as the day wore on and darkness approached in D.C., marchers started placing their homemade protest signs along the fence around the White House. First, just a few, then whole stacks of them, creating something between a collective art installation and a simulated barricade. And then the protesters went home, as protesters had done after dozens of major demonstrations before them. Some, no doubt, felt that they had now done their part, having contributed their bodies and voices to the momentous gathering. But both at the big D.C. march and at the hundreds of sister marches all around the country, a noteworthy number of protesters, mostly women, took the day as a call to further action. You could feel it in the determined mood of the crowd, and you could read it in the signs, an intimation of the bottom-up, women-led organizing to come. All around the country, an impressive number of those who marched were galvanized into further action, taking the sense of collective power they felt in the streets and carrying it forward. Back in their local communities, they donated money to progressive organizations and made phone calls, millions of phone calls, to their elected representatives. They joined existing groups and formed thousands of new ones. They took on the unglamorous and often invisible work required to keep those groups going. They showed up for many subsequent protests, both local and national, ensuring that every initiative by the new president was met by loud and visible opposition. They turned out in large numbers for politicians' town hall meetings, and thousands decided to run for office. They registered people to vote and went canvassing door to door for progressive local candidates. The difference was palpable and dramatic. Movements had created big marches many times before, but this time, in a way that was impossible to predict and marvelous to observe, marching had created a movement. Thank you. I would like to introduce Anila Afzali, and I am so honored to have you here tonight.
Thank you so very much, L.A. Kaufman. And thank you to all of you for being here with us for this, I think, a very relevant and timely conversation. And I want to start maybe by just asking, how many of you have been involved in a protest? I expect all the hands to go up. Okay, good to see that and good to know that.
Yeah, if I can interrupt, I'd like to see how many of you had ever been to a protest before Donald Trump was elected? All right, we've got the hardcore here.
This is a good audience, yeah, then.
These are our people.
Well, because that's a very good point, because there's a lot of people who are just mobilized by the ascendancy of Donald Trump. So it is good to see some people who are actually veterans of protests. I've certainly been involved in a lot of protests for a while, including at the organizational level, so I know some of the challenges that come with that. And I want to start maybe by asking some specific questions of you, LA, and maybe we can all benefit from the responses. And the first point I want to start with is something that you mentioned, which had to do with the signs in the 1963 march that were very controlled versus the women's march that was very uncontrolled. Talk to us about the pros and cons of each one of those two approaches, because I can see both. And I personally have been involved in certain protests where we really wanted to control the message, in particular because it has involved certain marginalized groups where media or others tend to demonize and use any messaging in a negative way and use it in a way to potentially hurt the communities who are out there. And I see this most importantly in there was an anti-Muslim hate rally that happened across the nation with Act for America, the largest anti-Muslim hate group. And the messaging for that protest, our response to the hate rally was to bring together a wide, diverse coalition. It was actually beautiful to see here in Seattle and across the country, but we were very particular about making sure that our signs stayed positive. We did not want people coming out and labeling everybody on the other side as racist and Islamophobes and, you know, using other bad words and things like that, because we had to control the narrative, because we knew as marginalized people, if a bad result comes out of that, if violence comes out of that, the people who are at the involved there, they can go home and get away from it. But the people who would be most impacted are, for example, the American Muslim community and other marginalized communities who would then face the consequences of the negative messaging and any sort of violence that may result. So we were very particular, and I remember sort of begging all the coalition partners to say, please keep it positive. Do not turn into negative messaging. Do not turn toward violence or anything else. So I wonder if that also plays a role in the 1963 march that was, you know, a lot of our Black sisters and brothers versus the women's march, which was overwhelmingly white. So I'd like to hear your thoughts both on the pros and cons and whether or not there was any race implications or involvement in that.
Yeah, well, I think absolutely with the 63 march, those kinds of concerns about how, let's say, rogue messages could be interpreted and how readily they would be seized upon were certainly a concern that the organizers of the 63 march had. The particular specific context was 63, and there was concern about messages that were too angry or too militant, because there was an awareness that that was the sentiment in some of the grassroots and that that might not play so well. It was not the image they were looking to project. And I think you have seen, for instance, in subsequent organizing by the Women's March organization, as opposed to the initial event that came together, a real attention to message control precisely in order to foreground the leadership of women of color and ensure that the framing of issues is intersectional. That there have been many, many other groups over time who have had reasons why they wanted to carefully frame the messages on their protests and even the way they looked. So ACT UP would be a really powerful example of that, where ACT UP developed a particular graphic style, a particular sensibility that was very aligned with their queerness, with their outrageousness, with the way that they wanted to speak truth to power. And they didn't like people showing up with, you know, they didn't like people like messing up the look with like a hand scrawled side, right? So, you know, so there's reasons, there's sometimes reasons that are aesthetic and are not specifically political or don't have to do with the dynamics among different elements in a coalition. So it's not as if I'm putting forward controlled signs bad, uncontrolled signs good as a simple dichotomy. But what I am pointing to is something about movement building and ownership. And there is a way in which the sense of ownership over that moment that women had in that first women's march, where they were all, without having gotten any memo that said, bring your own signs, when they were all just moved to make their own signs, that there was something in that that was in that mood that helped shape what happened going forward.
One of the things, too, is symbolism at these marches, at these protests. You know, it's very significant, for instance, to, in certain cases, to have an American flag, especially when the whole notion of patriotism seems to be dominated at times by one party or one side. And I personally am an advocate or have been an advocate of trying to reclaim that narrative of patriotism. It is one of the most patriotic things you can do to get up and protest against injustice, in my mind. So I see that as very patriotic. We care enough about our country that we want to make it better, that we are out there, you know, using our bodies, using our voices, using our feet, and trying to make a change. So I think the symbolism issue also plays into some of these with the language of the and the messages of the signs. So I was just curious if you have any thoughts about some of that symbolism.
Right. Well, there was that. That's an example in not so distant history when there was really intense debate over the signs, which was in the immigrant rights protests of 2006. I don't know if people remember, but those stand as some of the very largest protests that we've had in U.S. history, particularly down in L.A. There were these massive, the Day Without an Immigrant, these massive walkouts, millions of people, and there was a lot of political tension around the first round of these protests, they came in a succession of waves. And the first round, a lot of people brought flags of their home countries out of just pride and connection to their homelands. Those were seized upon by Fox News and other right-wing outfits. It means, you know, that they're just here for Mexican pride or, you know, whatever racist anti-immigrant narrative you want to have. So there was a real attempt by the organizers in the subsequent ones to encourage people not to carry any flags but American flags. When you make a political request like that, there's going to be people who aren't comfortable with it. These questions about signage end up intersecting with sometimes deep organizing conversations that people need to have and maybe don't have the time to have in the course of quickly mobilizing to respond to a crisis, because as exactly as you say, I mean, the symbolism involved has deep meaning.
Absolutely, and I think actually the fact that there was a lot of American symbolism at the Muslim ban protests, that actually really helped shape public opinion and shift public opinion, because initially people were in favor of it. There was a large percentage of people who supported the ban on Muslims. And then once sort of the protests happened and the symbolism and recognition that this is a violation of our American values, and this goes at the core of sort of what makes us American and our constitutional values and other values like that, that you started seeing the poll data show something different.
That's Anila Afzali and L.A. Kaufman on the enduring power of protest. This is Independent Alternative Radio.
I think you're also right on the point that some of this has to be conversations, because there is disagreement oftentimes in the parties that come together to organize, or the organizers or the organizing groups behind a lot of these sort of mass protests. So that actually gets to the second question or second big area that I wanted to explore with you, which is really this idea of in coalitions, when you're building coalitions to try to make an impact in some of these very large areas, and you have groups from very different backgrounds and people from very different backgrounds coming together, how do you manage the differences that often arise? The differences in sort of methodology, the differences in tactics, the differences in viewpoints of messaging and symbolism, and, you know, just even basic differences between different parties, but they're all trying to come together, or they all care about this one issue. How do you sort of manage that?
I don't know that I have a simple answer for how you do
Come
that.
On, LA.
I'm sorry, but except to underscore how crucial that work is, and how that's some of, you know, when I was talking about there being all this unglamorous work of movements, that, I mean, that certainly isn't glamorous, right? We've all been in meetings that, you know, but it can sometimes be some of the most enduring. Like when I look back at that anti-war work that we did in 2003 and 2004, the beginning when I was saying, well, it didn't work. I obviously think it accomplished more than just enabling us to feel good about ourselves in the morning afterwards, because we'd taken some kind of stance. And one of the things that I think in that particular case was some of the really enduring value of the work we did was the coalition that we built in United for Peace and Justice. Before the Iraq anti-war movement, I think it's pretty fair to say that the peace movement in this country was overwhelmingly white. Overwhelmingly. United for Peace and Justice very early on made this decision at the February 15th, 2003 march. Three quarters of the speaking slots were allocated to people of color. And the steering committee, once we first had a formal steering committee, was 50% people of color, which maybe doesn't sound that radical now, but in 2003, this was not a common practice on the left. And years later, the relationships that people built and the trust that people built slowly over time, with bumps along the way and disagreements and conflict and all of that, and I think it still continues to bear fruit. But for example, behind the scenes in Ferguson, Missouri, when there was the uprising there after the police shooting of Mike Brown, some of the ways, if you kind of know what happened behind the scenes, some of the ways that response came together and was elevated from being just an angry initial response into an ongoing organized movement had to do with relationships that were forged on the United for Peace and Justice Steering Committee, that there were these cross-racial relationships built over time, years before, that then people could call on in this new moment of crisis. So while I don't have a simple answer for how we work it out, I mean, I do think that it's important to come up with structures that are containers that can allow multiplicity, where we can have multiple political philosophies, multiple tactical preferences, multiple ways of being, and manage to work alongside each other in solidarity. I don't think we're ever... There's a wonderful essay by Bernice Johnson Reagan about coalitions from the Homegirls anthology, which is a black feminist anthology from the 1980s that just comes to mind. And it's sort of like, if a coalition isn't uncomfortable, it's not big enough. If you're not in coalition with people who you really kind of don't like, if you haven't expanded your circle widely enough, it's not a big enough coalition. So I guess my response is that we have to like just live in that discomfort and work through it, because that's kind of the heart of the political work.
Well, I guess some of my coalitions definitely have been big enough, because faced some of that.
When I look at the numbers about protest under Trump, it's always staggering. I keep a spreadsheet of the numbers of people who've been cumulatively protesting under Trump on my wall, because the numbers are, I know I'm a kind of a protest geek, but the numbers are so high. It's been between 14 and 22 million people have protested since Trump took office. There's nothing close to that in the past. And the question had been hanging over us: was it going to translate into retaking institutions of power in any meaningful way? And I think it did. I mean, retaking the House is huge. Retaking the state legislatures that we took is huge. Restoring the voting rights of folks who've been convicted of crimes in Florida is huge. You know, the wins that we had are really enormous and consequential. And they are absolutely because of the way in which people dug in to this get out the vote work. And then the fact, to my mind, that this work was done so autonomously of the Democratic Party is like the second huge win of the night, because the Democratic Party is not going to save us. And electing a Democratic House is not going to magically create a bulwark against Trump. We have seen how anemic they've been, utterly toothless. Obviously, there's some good eggs in the bunch who are going to be strong leaders no matter what. But on the whole, what's going to hold them accountable is going to be us. And it's going to be our continued willingness to apply pressure by marching in the streets, by getting on the phones, by organizing in groups, by exercising pressure in all kinds of ways, but by doing it in the same spirit that we've been resisting till now, which is to say, not waiting for permission, not waiting for direction, you know, certainly not waiting for the Democratic Party to tell us to go pressure it to do something real, because that ain't gonna happen, but by continuing to stand strongly for these values that we hold dear and that are being violated every single day under this presidency. Why don't we open it now to questions?
The protests are amazing. The grassroots effort is amazing. It's great that people are rising up who never rose up before. But whereas Richard Nixon could actually be intimidated by large crowds of protesters, Trump just leaves town and goes play golf.
And we haven't surrounded the White House yet.
And makes crazy suggestions that those protesters should be charged with being terrorists. Even the peaceful, you know how he wants to charge people who protest. And so it's like he leaves town, he doesn't care, he doesn't talk about it, he's a sociopath, he just does his own thing and makes believe it's not going on. So what about that?
Well, let me first, I want to just respond to on the Nixon point, because Nixon was very similar. If you've ever heard of his famous silent majority speech, that was given in the wake of what was to that moment the largest upsurge of protest ever in U.S. history. We've now greatly exceeded it. But his response, there's a theatricality to those denials, and that was true for Nixon, and it's true for Trump. So Nixon at the time was saying, these are just scruffy ne'er-do-wells, and the real majority is the silent majority. It's only with the benefit of hindsight and the fact that, you know, a variety of records from inside the Nixon White House are available that we know how rattled he was by those protests. So because Donald Trump performs that he doesn't care doesn't mean he really doesn't.
Yeah, and I would just add that we're living now in this internet age. It doesn't matter where anyone goes. They could go to a different country. Does not matter. They will see the images. They will see it on video. They will see covered in media. It doesn't matter if they're not physically there right themselves. And I will say with Trump in particular, perhaps even more than many other presidents or many other individuals, he cares what people think about him. You know, he is very narcissistic. He is very much like, he is in some ways Teflon, like the things that you throw at him doesn't really stick, but he absolutely cares and he pays attention to that. That's why crowd size was so important to him. That's why, you know, so many other things. So he does care about it. He does see it and he will see it. And it isn't, and I think going back to your point earlier, LA, it's not even about protesting against Trump himself. It's really changing public opinion. That's the way I look at it. Honestly, I try to stay away from even critiquing Trump himself. I put him aside. He's not the target for my sort of criticism or my sort of advocacy work. The work that I do, like you mentioned, people in the Democratic Party who need to be moved, who need to, I mean, especially now with the House being taken over by the Democrats, now's the time for us to be contacting our representatives and making sure us holding them accountable, because otherwise they may not do the right thing for a number of different reasons. It is up to us to really push them and hold them accountable, because before they had the excuse that they were not in a position of power. Well, guess what? Now they have power. So now they need to hear from us even more. And we need to make sure that we, the people, are driving the agenda and making sure they do what we hold them accountable for. So that's what I would focus my attention on. And I think the media attention and just the mass protests and the mass organizing and the mass movement work absolutely will make a difference, whether it's in the public or behind the scenes.
Thank you. My concern is that there's been an impression that the anti-fascists show up, the Proud Boys show up, and they're basically looking for a gang fight. And I have enormous respect. As I said, it was happy to see them there, and they were peaceful. But I wonder if there's a better way to coordinate, just as there were in many mass protests, there were organized martial groups. If there's any way to reach out to them and get them to coordinate with labor and with marshaling groups so that they are a defense against the fascists, because we know that fascists want to start a fight. They're not afraid of being punched in the face. They like it. It helps their street cred. So if there's a way to coordinate with the anarchist, black bloc, antifa, whatever you call them, so that they're part of the movement and not just a separate group that just have gang fights, which only feeds into what police provocateurs want.
Well, that goes back to the coalition building question, right? I mean, those would be some tactical differences that people have. And there have been moments, the last time I was in Seattle was 1999 during the World Trade Organization protests. So it's a little weird to be here without tear gas everywhere. It's changed a little over time. But, you know, that was a moment when there was a real split in the movement around, you know, they're now called the anti-fascists, and it was the black bloc over tactical choices. And there was sort of, let's say, bad behavior on all sides that the black bloc crowded into the space and time that groups that were trying to keep their events strictly nonviolent wanted to keep, you know, a buffer around, so the black bloc behaved badly. But then some of the, you know, self-described peaceful protesters behaved badly by denouncing the black bloc publicly in the media. And after that, there were a lot of really powerful closed-door conversations that brought together a huge range of folks, from anarchists, on one end to organized labor and everybody in between. And there was a whole period when there were these written solidarity agreements that were quiet, that weren't a public thing, but that were understood and that were, a kind of a form of how do we deal with the fact that we have fundamental disagreements about what's violent and nonviolent. We have fundamental disagreements about what's the best strategy, but we need to not be denouncing each other publicly, and we need to not be endangering people who want to come to a protest and have reasonable expectations for what level of risk they're placing themselves in. Know whether they're coming to a legal permitted march where they can bring their kids and their grandma and their friend who's a power chair user, or they're going to some place where they can expect that things are going to get rough and tumble. I can't speak for all around the country, but I don't know. Sometimes I feel like the Obama years, like the slumber that a lot of people went into during the Obama years, that in that long sleep, there's all this movement infrastructure that we lost. We lost a lot of habits. We lost a lot of structures. And so, we lost things like we don't do action guides the way we used to. I don't see people doing trainings the way they used to. And we're not having those conversations the way that we used to. So my only answer is more dialogue.
Yeah, and I would just add that absolutely conversations need to be had, but I don't like the idea of feeding into exactly what the, Proud Boys, Patriots Prayer, or some of these white Christian fundamentalist types want. I don't like that idea of giving them that. They want attention. And oftentimes their numbers are very small compared to the people who show up in opposition. And the more we sort of feed into that, it really sort of helps elevate their status. And I do not like that. I also, just for faith reasons, I absolutely, as an American Muslim, as a Muslim in general, absolutely am against violence. So I'm not, do not want to be part of any of these movements that involve violence in any way. And actually, that was one of the big pieces that we had to talk about, because I was very adamant that at times, particularly when you're talking about certain people, they are able to get away from the narrative that comes out after, or the consequences do not follow them. And the consequences do directly impact the marginalized groups. So with the Muslim hate groups that had shown up, I made a very strong case to people. And I said, look, if you want to put your ego or your emotion ahead of the community or the cause, then go do what you're doing. But don't say you're doing it for the American Muslim community. Don't say you're doing it in solidarity with Muslims, when the Muslims here are directly asking for nonviolence, are directly asking for sort of positive messaging. So that was something that I think needs to be discussed every single time. And I do believe that the most marginalized, most impacted communities have to be given the lead on those kinds of decisions.
Just again, thank you for such thoughtful responses. I'm thinking a lot now about this urban-rural divide. And as I listen, I in a sense, and of course have been part of protests, it strikes me as kind of an urban phenomenon. We know that the situation is stacked against the numbers, that in favor of the rural districts, et cetera, as far as how things have been gerrymandered, et cetera. So I'm just curious your thought about the relationship of protest and this challenge we have between the urban mass and the rural community, who really get a different kind of media entirely. Their communications patterns are different, the cultural surroundings are different. And so what are your thoughts on impacting that?
I have a lot of thoughts on that, because I actually, although I live in New York City, but I spend part of my year in, and have for 20 years, in a part of upstate New York. It's part of the swing district where we just defeated John Faso, yay, and elected Antonio Delgado after an unbelievably racist campaign that didn't work in an overwhelmingly white district. And so I was, last weekend, I was up there in New York 19, I was in these tiny little town. I was in one sort of medium-sized town, another town that the locals do called Trout Creek, in Trout Creek, New York, in an area that went, I think, 2-1 for Trump, going door to door. I've been doing lots of anti-racist organizing in that area for the last couple of years around a campaign that I started against the Confederate flag at our local county fair. So I've been kind of deep in this question of how do you do rural anti-racist organizing in a pro-Trump area? And I think, at least in what I've seen, I mean, you know, there's a lot more happening in rural. There's a lot more, that's undecided in rural areas than we think of when we just write them off. That I think that there's a lot that first of all, like those numbers about the 650 protests or the 900 protests, that means that things are happening in smaller cities, which are regional hubs for rural areas. So, you know, there may not be something in Trout Creek, but there's something in nearby Delhi or Oneonta, the next larger towns nearby. You know, so the things that are for people in that little rural area are the hub. And maybe those protests only have like 20 people standing up against the family separation policy or, you know, whatever the issue is. But 20 people in an area like that is really something. I think it's like any other kind of organizing. It's about the getting out and talking to people. So in this area where we just won that district as part of the campaign around the Confederate flag and sales of the Confederate flag, our local organizing group has had a 2-year-long anti-racist film series at the local little community college. And it brings, you know, it's 40 or 50 people once a month. And that kind of stuff has a cumulative effect. You know, it's easy to assume that the rural areas are just so economically precarious at this point in American history that they're unreachable politically. And certainly, like in my area, I saw, you know, after the Grab Your Pussy tape came out, I saw people mobilizing more for Trump rather than less. So I kind of knew he was going to win before he did from seeing that up there, seeing how people responded by wanting to, like women, white women, wanting the Trump yard signs after he said that. So I think rural areas are very much in play, and I do think white women are the key. I think it's a question of trying to, you know, I don't know about rural white men. I don't know if we can reach them or not. We've seen that the numbers yesterday about how white women voted around the country were in some places just awful. I mean, Georgia, it was something like 79%. It's like some just absolutely overwhelming margin of white women for Kemp. But the national average, I take some heart in the fact that the national average of white women voting Republican went down from 53 to 50. And I think that when we talk about persuading people and bringing them over, this work, particularly for fellow white women, anti-racist white women to take on, that this is the crucial block to try to shift in the rural vote, is for progressive white women to try to reach out to white women who are sort of wavering and who could be pulled in a more progressive direction. Yeah, and I'll just circle back by bringing us back to the theme of protest, because I think part of why and how protest works is that it brings people together in real space, in real time. We put our bodies next to each other. We feel our sense of ourselves as a collectivity, which is the thing that, you know, happens in houses of worship all the time where people get together. There's a power in that, a power especially, not sort of like in spite of this internet age, but especially because so many of us live so much of our lives digitally, that part of the enduring power of protest is that it brings us together to speak as one in a physical space. And we know from history that that matters and that the impact of that plays out over a long time. And thank you, all of you, for coming out tonight.
That was L.A. Kaufman. And before her, you heard Anila Afzali on the enduring power of protest. They spoke in Seattle. L.A. Kaufman is a veteran organizer of mass marches and direct action protests. She's the author of How to Read a Protest, The Art of Organizing and Resistance. Anila Afzali is the executive director of the American Muslim Empowerment Network at the Muslim Association of Puget Sound in Washington. This program is produced by Alternative Radio based in Boulder, Colorado. We are independent and part of the nonprofit media organization Rise Up. We are supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature progressive voices rarely heard in the media, such as Leilani Farha, Dar Jamil, Kali Akuno, Tariq Ali, Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, and Ilan Pape. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. Special thanks to Jonathan Shipley and Tom Worrell. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening.